Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Oh, I dearly love that song. Welcome to Yada Radio. Chaga, which means to celebrate, to have a marvelous party, Shabbat, the seventh day. I'm here with Kirk. We may have JB. I think JB may also be on an extended vacation, but always good to hear the voice of my friend Kirk. How are you this evening?
I'm fine, Sam. I'm doing fine. Glad you're back. We miss you.
Yeah, it's lovely to be back. And this evening, I am speaking to you from one of the most really beautiful places in America. I'm in South Beach.
Wow.
Now, South Beach, which is just across Biscayne Bay from Miami.
Mm-hmm.
Sound about as far from you, Kirk, as a person can be. You're in California.
You're not kidding. How's your weather?
Yeah. You know, it was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful day today. I'm really delighted to be here. It's a very different environment than what I have become used to. We are beginning now, having moved out of the test that Yahweh posed for Abraham. We're now moving into a presentation that I think parallels it. So the last four or five shows, Kirk, we have focused on the test that Yahweh created that was an open book test to verify that Abraham and Yitzhak understood the terms and conditions of the covenant and were willing to act upon them. And it was a marvelous presentation of us coming to realize that God doesn't give two hoots about faith.
No.
It's just about, do you understand? Do you like what I'm offering? Are you willing to accept what I'm offering? And it was a cerebral and action-oriented experience. One of my favorite depictions in the entirety of the Torah. But it came to, at least from my perspective, I began to see all of what we had experience regarding Abraham and Yitzhak going to Mount Moriah and finding Yahweh providing the lamb caught in the thicket, and of God Himself saying, I'm going to provide the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. I began to see that in the light of Pesach, Passover. And to me, it was a brilliant explanation of what transpired in Yeshayah 53. I mean, people around the world, with the exception of rabbinic Jews hate 53 because, in fact, they'll go through the, you know, the Torah prophets and Psalms. They'll skip 53. They won't even talk about it because Yeshayah 53 is is the kryptonite to the religion of Judaism. Mm-hmm. But it struck me, Kirk, and I'm willing to be challenged on this. I've never claimed to be inerrant. I just claim to thrive on the insights that can be gleaned from properly translating these words. And, right. And as you know, my favorite thing is to make the connections between various things. It seems to me that what we have just discussed regarding this test that is presented in Bamashit and the Torah is really an explanation of and a celebration of what is explained by the marvelous prophet Yeshayah, and that 53, the most magnificent of all of the prophecies. I don't think there is a prophecy more magnificent than 53. That it is only understood in the context of Bamashit 26-27, as we have been studying the test that Yahweh established for Abraham on Mount Moriah, and of God himself saying, you don't need any lamb, I'm going to provide the lamb. I see these two things as not only inseparable, but one only being understood in the context of the other. So it might, for some people's ears, seem silly, seem inappropriate, to jump from the middle of Bamashit in the Torah and the conclusion of this covenant relationship with Abraham and Yitzhak and Yahweh to a prophet that would not even emerge on the scene for, oh, we're talking about 1968 BCE to around 700 CE. We're talking about 1,200 years before what we have just witnessed is fully explained.
Mm-hmm.
Of this, precisely how Yahweh was going to provide that land. And it's interesting that it's also 777 years from the time that Yosha wrote these words. It would be exactly 777 years at the time they were fulfilled. I see them as inextricably linked.
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, as I told you before we went on the air, that I spent probably, 25 or more hours just breaking down these words with about 7 different lexicons for the whole of 53, 1 through 12, that is, and I believe that's all of that section. And it is more confirming than even you let on to. I mean, I'm not critiquing you. I'm just saying if you get into it like I like to do and play with the words, I mean, just keep looking up the words and looking up the letters and so forth, it is overwhelming. I was talking with one of our today, even talking about just one of the verses and two of the words, and it was so overwhelming. It was, who can debate that unless you just want to scream at somebody? You can't debate
it. Yes, right. It's my conclusion that you don't need any faith, no belief. It's all laid out here for us to amon. In fact,
that's the core of Mi'aman.
Right, it begins with Mi'aman. Whoever, whenever, whosoever, wherever, it doesn't matter who you are, where you are, when you are. Mi tells us that no matter who you are, where you are, when you come upon this, the single most important thing is to Mi'aman. Is to trust and rely. And all of this is presented on our behalf so that the validity of the testimony we are considering is affirmed, confirmed, verified, seen as trustworthy and true. And once you come to the realization that this is so brilliant and so interrelated and so affirming that you come to a place where you are convinced that it is true, and you recognize you can rely and depend upon it. Isn't that what Aman means?
Exactly. It's totally. I wrote in my little gnosis, you know, it's not faith, it's not belief, because every lexicon I went to and every way that Aman is spelled out, a Yah Aman or Yah Men, it confirms that this is something that's trustworthy because it's a verifiable testimony based on facts. I mean, it is an established pillar.
It is what we have us. I mean, I say we because I think there's so many of us now have come to this position that God is knowable through evidence and reason, and that He is only knowable through evidence and reason. So it's one thing to say that He is knowable through evidence and reason, which destroys the myth of
all religion.
Right, that He is knowable through evidence and reason. I'm willing to go one step further to say He is only knowable through evidence and reason.
Well, He's only trustable if you have the facts. I mean, otherwise you're just hoping. So, yeah.
All right, so the facts have been presented here, and now you see Yahshua affirming specifically what Abraham had experienced and explaining it so that we can trust and rely on this testimony. So, whosoever, wheresoever, whensoever, trusts and relies, confirms the enduring validity and verifies the trustworthy nature of the testimony to the extent that they are convinced that it is reliable, dependable, and true. Law approaches in accordance with our message. Anahu is our, and Shamua is information, that which has been reported and announced, the instruction and teaching that has been revealed. Now, while 53 is in the midst of this marvelous prophetic pronouncement of Yahshua, Yahshua, who is speaking for Yahweh, is not speaking of what He has revealed in the first 52 chapters of this book. When He says, somebody that approaches in accordance with the message, with the information that has been imparted, what He's talking about is the information that has been departed in the Torah. That's what He's speaking of. Yahshua is, first, Yahweh is way too unpretentious. And Yahshua is extraordinarily humble. Yahshua would never say that someone could affirm Yahweh's testimony and could approach based upon what I have revealed. But what they're speaking of here is the Torah.
Right.
And so this is whosoever, whensoever, wheresoever, trusts and relies, confirms the enduring validity, and approaches with our message. The information we have reported and announced, the instruction and teaching we have revealed. This is not, this, I mean, let's be really careful here. The voice here is the creator of the universe. This is not the prophet speak. The prophet is not clean. Yahshua, remember we started this not too long ago, and Yahshua was trembling for fear that he had blown it. Because God was angry that he had thrown open the door to heaven and there was no one there. And Yahshua said, I have failed you. I'm the person to blame since you've chosen me to be the person you're speaking through. And you've thrown open the door to heaven and there's no one there. I'm so sorry. I feel inadequate. And God said, no. It's not your fault. So you've got to know that there's no chance that this is the prophet speaking for himself. Our message has nothing to do with Yahshua and everything to do with Yahweh.
Well, thus far, everything has come right out of the Torah through what he quoted to Moshe. We've been talking about the story that Moshe recorded about Abraham. So, yes, it's all direct from Yahweh.
So, yeah, isn't it interesting, too, that the word for message, Shamua,
is related to Shama, yes.
Yeah, it's related to Shama, and it's related to Shamar. Shamar meaning to observe, and Shama meaning to listen. So this is, and it's obviously feminine, and the Torah and Bereth are both feminine nouns.
Mm-hmm.
So is our message feminine? Because it ends with the information we have reported and announced. And is to whom the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh has been revealed and made known. When you read that, it's obvious that the sacrificial lamb caught by the horns on Mount Moriah is the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh.
Yes.
This is Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
Yosha is the Zorora, the seed, the forearm, the shoulder, the might, the very hand and arm of Yahweh. And I don't think, Kirk, it's possible for anyone to know who he is and his role in all of this apart from these messages, apart from the role that he is depicted and playing in the Torah. And that's the part that religious people all miss. They have no understanding as to who the sacrificial lamb of Pesach is because they view him out of context.
That's fair.
And this is saying, view it in context. Now, you know that I'm sure you know, because I have made such a big deal about the fact that Zororah, when it is presented in the Torah, almost universally speaks of the Pesach lamb. So when Zororah is used in the Torah, it is addressing the Pesach lamb. When Zororah is used in the prophets, it's almost always rendered arm. Or arms, as in the shoulder to the wrist. Arm or arms. Sometimes it's translated shoulder, sometimes it's translated arm, sometimes it is, even though it's a singular term, it's rendered in the plural. And this was one of the words, Kirk, that very early on was one of the first words that I said, I don't think so. And I don't have a problem with Yosha as the physical manifestation of Yahweh, and therefore the arm of Yahweh. Mm-hmm. I have no issue with Yosha being Yahweh on his knees to benefit us. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a problem with it being translated arm. I just don't think that's the primary or intended meaning. I think the primary
No, I was just going to say, if you use it as Yahweh's arm as an instrument of deliverance and judgment, then that makes it even stronger. But I even found another related one, which is Zorach, which is same root with the gathering souls, which is the first two letters mean. But interestingly, Zorach is to sprinkle water or blood on an object, like the mercy seat. I mean, there's so many clues he's given us with so many words that are related, who else can you be?
I want to interrupt just because I want to play off something you just said.
Okay.
The sacrifice that Yosha, the Christian Jesus, made is absolutely and wholly and completely irrelevant, totally moot, unless it fulfills Yahweh's Torah promise.
Mm-hmm.
And the Torah promise about the sacrificial lamb is for the blood of the sacrificial lamb to be sprinkled on the mercy seat. And the mercy seat isn't just some fanciful object. The mercy seat is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is the mercy seat. They're one and the same. Inside are the 10 statements. On the outside, always associated with it, is the Torah.
Torah, right.
And so, what is the mercy seat? The mercy seat and the Ark of the Covenant is the seat of honor that we earn, that we are given, we don't earn so much, that we inherit and that we are given, that enables us not only to sit as the heirs to the universe, as Yahweh's sons and daughters. It is the seat for covenant members. And that seat comes with wings, golden wings, which makes us like them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Eternal beings of light that are no longer restricted to two and three dimensions. It's the seat of perfection. It's the seat of honor. It's the seat beside Dad in the covenant family. And so, when you make the connection between the Roah as the sacrificial lamb and the function of that lamb on Pesach with the mercy seat as it's explained in the Torah with the Ark of the Covenant, now there is what this statement reveals. Mm-hmm. Now there is understanding. And
If you want to go one step further, what does a Christian do with the verse in Matthew where Yahusha says, I came to fulfill this?
And this is what he's fulfilling.
Yeah, right. He totally boxed in.
Yeah, the Zerorah is what he's fulfilling. The lamb caught in the thicket on Mount Moriah where Yahusha says, I will provide the sacrificial lamb. That is what he's fulfilling. He's fulfilling the Torah. He's fulfilling these prophetic statements, he's honoring these statements as the sacrificial lamb. And it's my view that unless you come to understand what Yahusha represents from this perspective, then you have no hope of understanding what Yahweh has done on behalf of his covenant children. And that anything that you take from Yahusha, even if you knew his name, is useless until such time as you view it from this perspective. The opening statement of Yahshua 53 is as profound as anything ever written. This is how the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh is known. And even if you want to take Zerorah to the arm of Yahweh, this is how the arm of Yahweh is known. And what's the first letter in Yahweh?
It's the Yod. The hand that lifts up. Right.
It's not just the hand, but it's the arm, isn't it?
The arm, yes.
It has
shoulder down.
The forearm. It's also the first letter in Yahusha, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, this statement encapsulates everything that's important for us to know. It doesn't matter where you are, when you are, or who you are, me. So long as you come to trust and rely upon, and then approach based upon in accordance with the message that has been revealed. And you are among those whom the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh has been made known, has been unveiled and exposed. Then you can approach God Himself. You come right in His presence and sit among the people. That is the process that we follow. And it's a marvelous affirmation, when properly translated, of everything we've come to know and learn. Any other thoughts before we move on, my friend?
Well, there was one last thing, you know, the last word in Galah, which I thought was quite interesting as well. It, you know, yes, it means to uncover and to remove or to reveal, disclose, etc. Uncover your eyes or uncover your ears. But it was funny. It made me think of the thing in Revelations when Yahusha is talking to Yochanan. And he talks about, you know, they should use the ointment. They rub it on their eyes so they can see what's going on.
Exactly. Where he's saying, what I recommend for you is that you apply this Tosh ointment. Yeah, and he was actually talking to the Laodiceans, which would be the those and the places where the people legislate. So it'd be in the Western democracies. Circa our time.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all these marvelous healthcare programs, he's poking fun at it. You know, God got a real sense of humor. And he's poking fun at it. He's okay. All you guys that have got these wonderful healthcare plans, and socialized medicine, Obamacare, in the 21st century, and a Western democracy. If you think you've got that you are wiser than anyone else, what I'm suggesting for you is some eye salve, so that you might actually recognize the truth. Because right now you are blind as bats.
Yeah,
and Allah is saying that these truths as to who the sacrificial lamb is and the role the sacrificial lamb is playing in relationship to the covenant is unveiled, is uncovered, is therefore seen by those who approach it through trust and reliance and analyzing the message, verifying the message for themselves. That's pretty darn stout. It's the second cerebral term, unveiled, exposed, to be seen. Those who approach by trusting and relying. Those who examine the revelation. And in this case, the revelation of the completed work of the sacrificial lamb. Galal. Yeah, it's a great term, isn't it, Kurt?
Gosh, yes. Yeah. What is so terribly interesting is every one of the words used in almost everything I can find in the whole series and the whole chapter 53 is so specific. And it's not like it's just one or two things. You know how sometimes you look up a word and you have five or six meanings and about three of them seem to fit the context? There's some of these words that might have 8, 9, or 10 or 12 meanings, and 10 or 11 of them are obviously fitting the context, and probably the 12th one too. You just have to think a minute on how that could be. I don't know how you do that with a language.
I may have been the first person in 2,500 years to translate Zeroa in sacrificial language.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be willing to bet that I'm the first person in 2,500 years to see Zeroa as sacrificial lamb of Yahweh, as opposed to the rabbinic renderings, which are the arm or shoulder of Yahweh. And I know I took a real, I thought it was an extrapolation. I thought it was an extrapolation from that which could be known, and that Yahweh did a marvelous job of introducing the Zeroa as the sacrificial lamb of the Torah. And that every time I came across it, when it was rendered that way, it made sense. In this particular statement, based upon what comes next, yeah, I was saying you got it right. This is one of those times, Kurt, where I know that I got it right, because the next statement God says, hey, you got it right. Listen to what comes next. And it cannot be the arm or the shoulder, but instead the sacrificial lamb. It says, for he grew up like any other infant before his presence, even similar to the roots under the desolate ground, so that no aspect of his appearance, nor anything dignified, nor majestic, nor even status would be seen in him. Nothing whatsoever in his appearance that we would desire him. Yeshayah, Isaiah 53:2. That can't be said of a shoulder.
No.
That can't be said of an arm. He is speaking of Yosha, full stop.
Yes.
And Yosha's primary role was not to stand up in the white robes with their arms outstretched so all the little children could flock to him. That wasn't his role. His role wasn't
if it wasn't to depict him in that role of being more humble or less spectacular, I mean, obviously he's not the tall, handsome guy with the wavy hair that the movies predict or show. Why would you include this if it wasn't to? It tells me two things. It tells me one, it was not pretentious. He used an ordinary body, you know,
right,
to do it, and it was the words that were the big emphasis, not the human being, because he wasn't charming and turned you to it, it's where you would gravitate to him. If you didn't gravitate to words, it was not because he was, you didn't gravitate because he was some handsome, charming fellow.
But this is so much that the world needs to hear. One is, God was not born.
Right.
Christmas is a pagan celebration. It has nothing to do with God. God was not born. There was no baby God in the manger. He was an ordinary kid. Like every other kid.
Yeah.
That's what this says. He was an ordinary kid like every other kid. He did not become the Son of God until the Spirit came upon him in the Jordan River. That is when he was transformed to more than who he is. It's the same way we, by the way, are transformed. When the Spirit of Yahweh comes upon us, we become sons and daughters of Yahweh. He was exactly the same way. So this whole myth of worshiping Jesus is rubbish. This whole myth of Christmas and God being born, we're celebrating God's birth, is total rubbish. It tells us that the conclusion that I drew, I know is one of the most controversial things I've ever said, which is that from Yahweh's perspective, goat is no different than Yosha. That from God's perspective, that this notion of worshiping, of creating a religion based upon Jesus, even if you got his name right, it's Yosha, is nonsensical. It's not what he's interested in. So the first thing is, don't worship Jesus. Do not think for a moment that he was an ordinary person. An ordinary infant. We learned that in Yashayam 9:6, didn't we?
Yes.
That he was born as a normal kid. We even learned it further on when they're talking about that he would be born of a young woman, not a virgin.
Right.
The virgin birth is totally, completely nonsense. Doesn't say that. This is really profound because, you know, one of the things we have come to realize is that Yosha, the Christian Jesus, is nothing more by comparison to a human being if you were to take a fingernail or a toenail clipping. To the entirety of you, that would be about the significance. Those who focus on Yosha versus Yahweh are missing everything. Those who don't recognize that Yahweh offered to honor his promise through the sacrificial lamb are missing everything. But our attention should be on Yahweh.
Yeah.
The second part of this work that I think is equally important. What this is saying is the same conclusion I've come to. I came to it for a very long time ago, and at first it made me uncomfortable, and now I celebrate it. God is not pretentious. He doesn't want to be worshipped. He doesn't want to be lorded over anyone. He doesn't want anyone to fear him. He's the creator of the universe, the author of life, and he is, you know, I could almost use the word humble.
Yeah.
He's totally and completely unpretentious. And he's doing it for a reason. Because he wants his creation to feel comfortable around him.
Yeah, he's approachable. It makes him approachable. Otherwise, he'd be scared to death.
Right. So you would think that if he's going to represent himself in human form, that human would be like, you know, Clark Gable, right?
Well, that would be our Hollywood version, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, Brad Pitt in today's terminology, right? George
sure.
Clooney. No, he's more like Kirk and Craig. That's what he's saying here.
Yeah.
They're not going to impress anybody.
Low for all and low adore.
I'm not trying to be imposing here. I'm not trying to impress you. I'm trying to tell you that if you understand who I am and what I'm doing, you're going to celebrate this, because this is really great stuff. But for the average person, you ain't even going to get it, because this idea, when I'm in Ohio, there's this this solid rock church that's got a 100-foot statue of Jesus. And he goes, no, you're missing everything. God's not pretentious, which means God can't be a Lord. Lords are all pretentious.
Yes.
He can't be feared. So God's going out of his way here to tell us something profoundly important about his nature and the relationship he seeks with us. And if you don't take the time to think about it, you'll miss one of the great truths in all of the universe. I mean, think of how profoundly different Kirk it is. And for all of those who are listening tonight or through the archives, how profoundly different it is to know that God is approachable and that he's not pretentious and doesn't want to be feared and doesn't want to be worshipped, but instead is trying to come across to us, to present his true nature to us in such a way that he's wholly and completely accessible, approachable, lovable, the same way a little child would come up and wrap their arms around dad's leg and then reach up to mom and dad's hand. That's how he is presenting himself.
And, you know, this is the third time we've run across a lot of material that says that. This isn't the first. So you alluded to it a minute ago.
This may be among the best, Kirk, but it's not the first.
Well, it is, because the next few words, you know, when he says, I'm not, or low to R, which is not handsome, not comely, not his form, his appearance, his shape, his outline, his silhouette, Hadar, you know, he goes on to splendor and beauty, as he's not splendid. He's not splendid, he's not beautiful, he's not handsome, he has no honor. Well, he went on to say honor and glory. Well, ultimately, yes, but not there. Not when he appears. His appearance is not good looking. He's not something to be noticed. He's not impressive. Desirable,
right.
Something to take pleasure in.
Right. Now, this is something that's also fairly profound. We have a number of prophets. Yahshua happens to be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Who, in a spiritual revelation, were actually taken up to heaven. Yahshua has seen Yahweh in heaven. Blew his little mind. He is talking about the light and the glowing and the warmth and the colors and all of the scene as the most magnificent thing he's ever seen.
Yeah.
And so in the seventh dimension, Yahweh is unbelievably spectacular. All right? So that's who he is in the seventh dimension.
And not here.
Yet in 3.5D, he's just an ordinary dude. Right?
Yeah.
Now, what does that tell us? That tells us that when we approach him in the material realm, he's just like us. When we approach him in the spiritual realm, guess what? We're just like him.
Well, that would be true too, yes.
So, it's not that God is not massively beautiful and brilliant and awe-inspiring. It's just that when we see him that way, we'll be the same.
Yeah.
So we are made like him when we see him in seven dimensions. And he is like us when he greets us in 3.5.
Yeah.
So we're always similar. That's what it means by we were made in his image.
Yeah.
In his image. He created us. Uh-huh. So when we are as part of the covenant family and we are in his home, we are just like him. And so, okay, it's brilliant, it's spectacular, but there's very little difference between us. And when he comes to the home he created for us, he comes in an unpretentious fashion so that he's just like us. So he's trying to establish here that this is not the scenario that I've used so many times. That if you, Kirk, had the ability to be more than just an artist, but you could actually create a living garden slug as opposed to just drawing one on canvas. And it's far greater than you saying to that garden slug, since I created you, the least you can do is praise me and lift me up and worship me and pray to me and tell me how wonderful I am, which it really, really ticked me about the first time it came out of the slug's mouth. What this is saying is that God specifically created us such that we could relate to Him in a family-oriented, from a family-oriented perspective, as sons and daughters would to their fathers.
That's really, very good. I've lost the words. That's really significant. You put it into words better than most folks can. Man, I realize we'd be like him there, and I realize we're like him here, and it's kinship, and he's of our same kind when he's here, and we will be like him. But that's well put, man. Absolutely.
Legitimately extrapolating. But I'm extrapolating from a base of understanding and from the perspective of the relationship. Why don't you share with me another reason for this statement of he's just going to look like everybody else. He's going to be just like every... we're talking about the Son of God here.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you come up with another reason that this statement is going to be made 777 years before it occurs, that is different than the explanation I've just given for it. I'll give you a year to come up with one. I don't think there is one.
Well, you've covered it. It says.
One legitimate reason for God saying it. And there's only one here. And if you don't take the time to consider it and to celebrate it, then what's the purpose of reading it? And if you read it and you think about it and you come to understand it, then what you have, you are left with this profound and magnificent understanding.
Yeah.
So I think that's the whole purpose of the message. I think it's written for us to be able to do that very thing. So, for he grew up like any other infant. Okay, God was not born. No Christmas. Before his presence. Before his presence. Yeah, it was presence. Even similar to the roots under the desolate ground. Why do you think he used roots here?
Well, he used your neck.
Why do you use root?
Because the metaphor he uses throughout is the tree
of the tree of life,
Israel and Yehuda.
Yeah, we're talking about the tree of life.
Uh-huh.
There are two branches in the tree of life, those and Yosha.
Mm-hmm.
And some out there in those branches, there's even a chota or two, aren't there?
Yeah.
A little stem off those branches. And by the way, being a shoulder, being a little stem off those magnificent branches, that's a really good place to be.
Yeah.
But where, when it talks about roots, where do roots go?
They go up. Oh, I'm sorry, roots go in the soil. There,
right.
You know,
where is this tree rooted?
In Jerusalem.
The intervention and Yisrael. So it is out of Yisrael and Jerusalem that this tree is rooted. The tree of lives is rooted right there. And once again, he used rooted for us to understand that Yosha isn't in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
He isn't in Washington. He's not in London. He's not in Paris. He's not in Moscow. He's not in Mecca. He's not in Tokyo. The chosen land is not the United States. It is Israel. And if you're going to have the right perspective You want to go to the right place, you've got to be rooted in the right place, grounded in the right place. And the roots are, of course, that which not only anchors the tree and keeps it from being blown over, it provides all the nutrients for the tree. Rooted. Trees are rooted. This is the tree of lives. It's rooted in Israel. Under the desolate ground, this is Eretz Sishka, the parched earth. Why do you think he used the term parched earth?
Well, I wrote myself a little note on that. Now, I was thinking in terms of, you know, parched earth is usually the description of a desert, where one, and it's also where it's not fertile soil. And certainly when he showed up then, it was not fertile soil.
Right. When you're talking about life perched, parched, it was certainly parched, desolate.
Mm-hmm.
What you're talking about is lifeless, dry, without living water.
Dry, parched land.
But a source of life. So you're talking about land without water, without a source of life. And what was Yisrael circa 33 C?
Pretty wasted.
Pretty wasted. Yeah, in fact, that was right before Hadrian and Titus did their, before Rome.
Talking of everything,
Yisrael, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was at a time where rabbinic Judaism was just taking a hold. And before Akiva, before Paul, this was a terrible time.
Yeah.
This was a time where the Romans would literally rip the skin off of the very representative, the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh, and then nail them to the most excruciating form of punishment and torture ever conceived by humankind. This was a lifeless place, wasn't it? And it's Yahweh's plan that out of lifelessness comes life. Out of the death of human institutions comes the life of the covenant. You know, we've talked about Midbar, and it is the desolate desert wanderings of the children of Israel. They went from the horror of the human religious and political and military and economic corruption of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, into the Promised Land. They spent 40 years in that wilderness, and Bamidbar is in the place without the word. That's what it literally means, the place without the word. And a place without the word is lifeless. So, being rooted under the desolate ground, so that no aspect of his appearance, lo, to our lahu, no part of his shape or form, nor anything dignified, majestic, denoting status, that could be construed as beautiful or noble, would be seen in him. So, all of these stupid paintings and depictions of the baby with the mountain child with that stupid halo.
Mm-hmm.
Good grief, folks. Throw it away, it's rubbish. Or the beautiful flowing robes and the perfectly cropped beard and the soft, long fingers. No.
No.
And for God's sake, get rid of your damn crucifixes. This idea of Jose Jalapeno on his steak. And now you're depicting God on a steak with a stupid crucifix. I mean, even Zion wouldn't go that far. And he goes pretty far with, Akbar, the terrorist. He goes pretty far with Jalapeno.
Yes.
But that is the Christian crucifix is dead, not on his feet.
No,
don't under any circumstances depict him that way. Nothing dignified. If there's nothing dignified, how do you create a religion around it? Right? Come on.
Well, it makes it even more remarkable. This description.
Yes.
I mean, it's just quite incredible.
nothing whatsoever in his appearance that we would desire him. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here. The idea, I've probably gotten more flack from the family on this than anything else. And, you know, and I don't mind that because if I'm wrong on this, but I've at least given people something to think about that know Yahweh and love His Word, then that's an okay thing. I don't mind being wrong if I give somebody something to think about. And I know I've gotten a lot of flack for being way too excited about the brilliance and the lyrics of them. But what this strikes me as is God saying, wait a minute, all of this fixation on Yahusha, on that even if you knew that he was HaMashiach, the anointed and prepared messenger of Yahweh, even if you know who he is, God, get over it. It's just Yahweh, a tiny, tiny diminished aspect of Yahweh fulfilling his promise. Stop fixating on him and look at Yahweh himself. Just stop it. It's you're making a, you know, for those who are just so into their jivas, stop it and just think for a moment. It's a toenail clipping. Don't get so excited about the damn toenail clipping and look at the being from which it came. Absolutely nothing whatsoever about his appearance. Yahusha is a physical manifestation of Yahweh on earth. Don't focus on it.
Well, isn't every word that Yahusha said was to point back to Yahweh?
Yes.
I mean, everything was about, go back to the Torah, go back to Yahweh, go, you know, look to Yahweh. Why are you asking me this? I mean, on and on and on and on and on.
I love my view of presence. I said, stop it. There is nothing about him whatsoever that you should desire. This didn't just say that he would not be desired by humankind. This says there's absolutely nothing about him that you should desire. That's even speaking of us who know him. We ought not desire him. And that's what he was trying to tell us. Stop making this big deal about me. Look at the Father who sent me. This is totally and completely devastating to the religion of Christianity if you understand what the words mean. And I don't think there's another way to interpret these words.
Well, you have four of them in a row where he says, you know, he says the same thing. He says, you know, it's not a good form. He's not beautiful. He's not handsome. His maraya, his appearance, he's not good looking. He's not impressive. And then you have Shemad, which is nothing to be desired here. There's, you know, there's nothing here to look at, folks. Take, you know, or take pleasure in it.
Right,
or to covet. I mean,
nothing
four words in a row.
Don't put God on his feet.
Yeah.
No God on his feet. Jalapeno or Jose, don't put him on his stick. There's nothing to look at here. Don't draw pictures of him in his mommy's arms as the Madonna and Chuck. There's nothing to look at here. Don't build 100-foot statues of him. There's nothing to look at here. Don't focus on him. Don't create a religion on him. There's nothing to desire here. Do you think that God's intent was for us to fall in love with the Pesach lamb?
Hardly.
Hardly.
He's got to be burned up, you know.
That's right. Well, Yahusha was burned up. The remainder of his physical body, which is the only thing that died, his soul did not die, went into Sheol on Matzah, and then was reunited with Yahweh's spirit on the Purim. It followed exactly the same path from a physical mortal to a spiritual being that we will follow, except we get this gift, the express day and seal. But this is at face value. Forget about trying to extrapolate. Just at face value, it not only destroys the myth of the Christian religion, which is the most popular religion in the history of humankind. It says, don't desire him. It tells us everything we need to know about our relationship with Yahweh and how he wants us to approach him. Mm-hmm. Do not approach through the sacrificial lamb. How many times, well, who do you think Jesus is? I know. But the very fact that you're asking the question tells me that you don't. And that the person asking the question has created a religion based on something they have no comprehension. And those of us who actually know who he is know that our attention ought not ever be focused on him. Kirk, do we have anything that he actually said in the language he spoke it?
No, sir.
Not a word, do we?
That's very significant.
Not even
he had 40 prophets. He was good.
Right. Not one word. Not one word has ever been retained and passed on to us that Yahshua, the Christian Jesus, said in the language he spoke. Not a single word. And yet, through the prophet, Yahshua, Isaiah, we have this profound testimony of exactly who he is and what he's going to do in the original language, in the voice of the creator of the universe himself. Which one is important? The one you know nothing about or the one you know everything about?
The one you know everything about. Of course.
Of course. Yeah. It ought to have been enough for a thoughtful person to realize I've got all this testimony in the original language that the universe came to exist in. That all of these promises were made. That in all of these prophetic affirmations that is true. The scientific affirmations that is true. The historic affirmations that is true. And I've got this wealth of information. You know, thousands of pages when presented in typical book form. And I got nothing on the other side. Do you think maybe there was a reason? I will grant you that Yahshua is more important than Yahshua. The Christian Jesus, who never knew his name, is more important than the prophet I did.
Somebody has to perform the Pesach and Matzah and Makarim.
So why don't you tell me how it would be possible for the prophet Yeshua to have not only several hundred pages of what he wrote retained, and the entire scroll available to us dating to 250 BCE, and available in its entirety, thousands of words, all retained in the original language, all spoken and inspired by the creator of the universe itself. And we don't have a single word from the Christian Jesus, not one.
Well, then you have to come to the conclusion that Yahweh was more impressed with what he told Yeshua than what anything that Matthew may have written.
I wouldn't use the word impressed. I would say that what he shared with Yeshua was far more important for us to know, and that there was nothing for us to know that he shared through Yahweh, the Christian Jesus. There were nothing that we needed to know from him, because everything we needed to know was already communicated. And that if we did not view who he is and what he did from that which had already been communicated, then anything that he said that was retained would simply be disorienting and disconcerting.
Yeah.
But the only way to understand it and appreciate it and capitalize on it is to view it from the perspectives of the Torah and the prophets.
Well, I was just going to say you throw in Dode's Psalm 22 and things like
right.
that plus Yahshua, and my gosh, you're overwhelmed with what is prophetic and more
right.
proof. But both of them, you have to go back to the Torah to read it. It would be
right.
it would be wrong, you know, to in my view, to find some kind of thing in Hebrew for the New Testament people. My God, you don't want to go there. It's
well,
so corrupted.
We know that the 22nd Mizmor song is profoundly important because it is one of the, when Yosher was actually on the pole of Pesach.
Right.
That's what he cited. He said, my God, why have you forsaken me? He is reading the opening line of the 22nd Psalm. Now, why it is that only one person in a million, maybe one person in a billion knows that, it's beyond me. But he's quoting from the 22nd Psalm because he's saying, if you want to understand what I'm doing here, you better read that. So while that's important, and it explains it, and it's the best eyewitness account of what was transpiring there, even though it was written 1,000 years before the event. Truthfully, the single best explanation of what was occurring is in that passage in Bereshit Genesis that provides the test to participate in the covenant. That is the single best explanation of what was happening.
Yeah.
And so all this doing in Yashayah is now explaining it in case you missed it. And the more ways that it's explained, the more affirming it is.
Well, that's what a good teacher does, right? Yahweh is the good teacher. He's the great teacher. So why
now,
would he not?
That's exactly how a great teacher teaches. The next time I'm going to read Kirk, I don't think was written to explain what transpired in 33 CE, year 4000 young. And while it's true, this happened in 33 CE, year 4000 young, if there were ever a time where we have to appreciate the fact that Hebrew has no past, present, and future tense, that it was, it is, and always will be, this is that time. And so before I read it, the perspective that I have garnered from it is that if you actually cite from Matanyah what Yosha said on what's called the Sermon on the Mount, the teaching on the Mount, Christians despise it. If you explain Yashayah Jesus from the perspective of being Torah observers, they hate it. When he is celebrating Pesach and not Easter, a Last Supper as opposed to the Pesach meal, Christians despise him. When he is presented as the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, Christians literally hate him. And so when I read this, what I want our listeners to consider for is how adverse all religious people are with the true nature of this sacrificial lamb. They didn't just hate him then. They despise him now. He was despised and viewed with contempt. He will be despised and viewed with contempt. He was considered to be of little value, worthless, despicable, and vile. You might, you know, I know this is tough for people to swallow because here is the world's largest religion based upon a corrupted Greek title for a title that is really never ascribed to him, certainly not as Christo, Christ. And really not even as Matiyah or Matiyah. It is almost wholly irrelevant. And you might say, well, you've got this largest religion that claims to take this title and base their entire religion on him. How can you say that they despise him and hold him in contempt? Because when you present him as he presented himself, they hate him.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I concluded that and wrote virtually the same thing that you just said. He said, he he was not just, if I can throw my two cents in, he's not just ignored or not liked. He's despised and hated. He is the Word and the Torah made flesh and representative of Yahweh. Therefore, Yahweh is despised and hated, as and his mitzvah, which is his the only avenue we have to be saved, to continue to live. And they hate all every aspect of it. How you if you cover up Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim with Easter, and you eliminate Matzah on top of it, don't even recognize that as anything. How much you're just spitting on the whole Torah.
When you and I end up in Shamanim, the seventh dimension with Yahweh, and we have an opportunity to greet people for the first time, Yahweh is going to be way down on my list. And I think everybody knows, those are going to be the first person I want to meet. But I really want to meet Jesse. I just think that the character of this man comes through in his words. I want to meet Chaba Oak. I just want to meet the lines in that, and they're just priceless. I love Noah. You know, he's a man after my own heart. Okay, I'm going to separate myself from humankind. I have no desire to be like them. And God says, build a damn ark. I'm just going to go and build it. I'm not going to question it. And there's a bunch of people that I really want to meet. I even think Yahweh Kahneman and Shimon Kefesh would be interesting characters to meet. So, I'm going to seek you out. And seek out the likes of Jackie, for example. Lisa, that listens to the program, and you all the correspondence with it, has so many brilliant insights. I'm Dr. Jeff, my good friend from high school days in grad. I'm going to seek you guys out long before I seek out yours. Because from my perspective, I don't even know if I would ever see Bob Yosha, because all he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. And the first person that's going to greet me is Yahweh.
Oh,
he's the person I most want to know. And then after that, it's the rest of the family.
Yeah, it is a little superfluous, isn't it?
It is.
You're trying to make Yahweh in totality. Yeah.
Yeah, if there was a diminished manifestation of you versus a real you,
yeah.
Why would I want to go to the diminished manifestation of you if I can have access to the real you? Why would I want to go to a diminished manifestation of Yahweh if I can actually walk up and sit right down next to the creator of the God of the universe? Why would I want to do that? Yeah. I don't. I have, in fact, it's just John. I mean, I actually have no interest. He wouldn't be in my top 100.
I'm sorry. Don't move to a Baptist town.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be in my top 100. You would be so much higher than he would be on the list of the order of people I'd like to meet.
Well, once again, in the context of Yahweh being in totality and you meeting him, there Yosha's diminished manifestation.
Correct.
It's ridiculous to think. Okay. Once you've seen Yahweh and met with him, you've met with Yahweh.
You met with Yahweh. I don't want to see a toenail at that point.
Yeah, there's nothing really more important than Yahweh.
But the covenant family really is a big deal to him, not just to him. It's a big deal to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, after we have had our meet and greet and had this marvelous encounter, I would have said, okay, where's the rest of the family? I can't wait to meet them.
Yeah.
I think that'll be his name mindset. Okay, yeah. Absolutely. That's why you're here. That is why you're here. So, again, the role of the Zoroa is profound. It is the literal fulfillment of a Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, and leading to Shavuot. And without the fulfillment of Pesach, which provides eternal life, Matzah, which makes us perfect, Bikurim, where we are firstborn children in Seattle's family in Chihuahua, where we were empowered and enriched. Without those things being enabled, without those promises being fulfilled, we have no hope of being part of the covenant and enjoying its benefits. So all of these things are profoundly important.
Mm-hmm.
But they are the method that God has used. And so as the method, we ought to understand it, we ought to appreciate it, we ought to respect it, we ought to accept it. But then let's move past it and write such that we're sitting there on that mercy seat right beside the Father. That's what this offering is all about. So he was despised and viewed with contempt, and therefore rejected by mankind. I'd say to this day he's rejected by mankind. He's not just, you know, the Christian would view this as, okay, it was the Jews who rejected him. Yeah, they did. So did the Romans. So did the Roman Catholic. The Protestant. The entire world has rejected who he is. The moment you tell him he was Torah observant, they rejected him.
You empty the room when you say things like that. You know, anywhere.
Yeah.
They'll just go, you're nuts, man. And then they'll hate you for it. They get vicious.
Yes.
Really?
A man who suffered mental anguish and physical pain. Excruciating pain. And, you know, when you have Yosha saying, God, if anything, I wish this could, if it was another way. That is the human side. What happened on Pesach was as painful for him as what happens with the Passover lamb. This was an anguishing experience. And he was familiar with sickness and affliction. Now, you don't very often think of you don't see the 100-foot statue of Jesus with the Kleenex and the symbols, do you? Bloodshot eyes and a runny nose. But he was not spared. And I think, Kirk, the fact that it says here, sickness and affliction, one of the things that I find that is the biggest stumbling block for those who say, look, I'm not buying that there's a God, because, you know, why would my son or daughter have to suffer like this? Why would some child suffer? If there was a God, they would never have allowed that suffering. Why was I raped?
And you're right. He supplied his own lamb. Yeshua didn't.
Right. Right. And so he is saying, I'm not going to spare in the physical world even my own. Why? Because if I interfere and if I preclude any form of sickness or disease or aches and pains or trauma from harming him, then I'm no longer dealing with free will. Now that entire thing, the whole concept of humanity is nothing but worse. We're pawns in a game to be played with. Okay, I'm going to take care of you. I'm not going to take care of you. Don't allow you to suffer, but no suffering over here. I'm going to intervene in your life, but not your life. It takes a really thoughtful person to realize that God can't intervene to preclude suffering without making a farce out of everything. And he's telling us right here, even with Yosha, my Zeroah, my sacrificial lamb, I'm not going to play this game of intervention. I mean, just like the rest of it. The whole physical experience is, by design, is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. It is mortal. It's designed to be mortal. It is limiting to 3.5 dimensions. It was designed to be limiting. If we are to go to the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th dimension, if we are going to forego all the limitations of the flesh, if we are to rid ourselves of any form of pain and suffering, then we need to know what Yahweh said, accept it, understand it, act upon it. We're going from something that is really, really good, you know, life in 3.5 dimensions with free will, and with a conscience, and with all the magnificence and beauty of love and relationships and life. We have something that's extraordinarily good. We're going from that, which has its aches and pains as it must, to something that is ultimately perfect. And it's the growth from one to another, it's the transition from one to another that is so marvelous. If all we ever knew was perfection, how would you ever appreciate it?
No, that would, you know, that's the garden story.
If we were made such that we had full knowledge of everything God wanted us to know and His mind, then where would the spirit of adventure be? How would you ever discover something that was satisfying? How would you grow?
True.
How would life become interesting? If you were born as all you could be, where would you find meaning, purpose, excitement, pleasure? So that's what I think is meant here, is that He was born like us, familiar with sickness and affliction, disease, injury. He even was exposed to evil. And that's the contrast that exists for all of us. And accordingly, they turn their faces away from Him, their presence away from Him, because we despised Him, and we did not rationally consider His actual value. And that is the whole problem of the Last Supper and of a Jesus that is worshipped on Christmas at Easter, that is part of Sunday worship services, that they have no idea who He is, no idea what He did. He's of no value whatsoever to them because they don't consider His actual value. His actual value is as the Passover lamb. His actual value is fulfilling the promise of matzah. His actual value is being the first to fulfill Bukurim. And as a result of all of these things, to provide Shavuot, the promise of Sabbath. And it's not just that they don't rationally consider His actual value. They turn their faces away from these things. They don't bother to observe who He is and what He did. And they're actually displeased by the truth of who He is. You know, diminished manifestation of God. Those are fighting words. And yet they're true. So that's Yahshua 53:3. Any one of those words that struck you?
The only thing I did when I was studying it was that when I got to Macab, or Kaab, I think that's the verb, and then Choli, where you have one is a mental suffering and the other is a sickness. I agree with you that he would have to endure everything that normal human being endures. But I also couldn't help but think about a deeper meaning where you have the mental anguish that he dealt with in Sheol, as well as the physical pain on Pesach on the upright pole. So I think it that as well. I mean, maybe that's just too obvious, but
it is.
But to me, I made a note on both. So I hear you.
Is false disease and afflicted by all of our mistakes?
Yeah.
And you know, Anna, when I think there's four of the Moed Mikra that speak of Anna, which you know, the Moed Mikra invitations from God for us to meet with Him and be called out to read and recite His testimony. And Anna is the answer. It's the RSVP. It's responding to the invitation. But as you know, the negative side of Anna means to afflict. So Yahweh afflicted himself so we wouldn't be afflicted. And those who respond and answer the invitation are not afflicted. And so here what you're seeing is that the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh was indeed afflicted. So we wouldn't be afflicted. Trolley conveys all of that. It's a very profound term.
Well, one thing about Sholi, you know, because I also found that it's called a piercing pain beyond just being a sickness, a disease, and a plague, which we're all affected by this horrible guy named Paul. But the piercing pain also ties in with his being pierced on the upright pole. So, it's all of the above, as it usually winds up being. I was deep.
Yeah. Nevertheless, a ken. And ken means to emphasize this point, truly, surely, make any sharp contrast, yet indicating that this is counter to normal behavior. Nevertheless, a ken. Our illness and affliction, he himself lifted up and carried away. So if he took our trolley, that he is explaining the purpose of Anah having a darkened light thought. So Anah, as the operative verb in four of the seven Moed Mikra, we answer the invitation, then he, Anah, is afflicted on our behalf. So nevertheless, our affliction, our illness, he himself lifted up and carried away. He suffered and endured. And our mental anguish he bore. And yet we ourselves devised a plot which considered him reaching out bodily, then forced into being viciously beaten and killed by God for responding and answering the call to be afflicted. Now this goes to, again, to the mindset of the Christian religion, that God came to die for them. It's just not true. This is the mindset of the vast majority of people, and it's not true. He was afflicted so that we wouldn't be. And it isn't just that he was the Pesach lamb that makes you immortal. That's wonderful. But immortal, and therefore still afflicted with sin, is the worst of all possibilities. Then you're going to be immortal and shield. A bad choice. So you really have to understand what it means that he was afflicted in conjunction with those four mikrae that state that on our behalf. And yet, you look at the plot, the ultimate plot of religion, is that God reached out bodily. Now, that's the Apostles' Creed.
Mm-hmm.
No. That's the plot. The plot that created religion. But it's not what actually happened. It's not what's important here. And now they'll view that the Jews tried to kill him. No, that was the Romans.
Mm-hmm.
And who became Roman Catholics. And that beaten and killed, yeah, that's the religious myth of God dying. So he's predicting here what will become the most popular religion in the history of humankind. And that it's nothing but a plot that would be perpetuated and a complete misunderstanding of the fact that he was responding and answering the call to be afflicted. So the word that I've come to, the verb I've come to love, it actually appears at the end of this. What it does is it says that your interpretation, Kirk, of Choli, which appears in the beginning, our illness and affliction he himself bore, and Anah are related concepts, and that we should connect them, and therefore we should connect them to the single most profound use of Anah in the entirety of the Torah.
Well,
my view, the most important one happens to be on the Day of Reconciliation, on Yom Kippur.
I just want to think of myself instead of you.
Reconciliation, then I'm going to suffer the affliction that you would have borne. That's exactly why Yahweh told Abraham, not only I hand on your son, I'm providing the sacrificial lamb, not you.
Mm-hmm.
In 53:4, you know, there's, if you look up an English Bible, they don't say it this way at all. Where we have Chesab as a plan, plotted, devised scheme, I call it the Jesus plot. Conceived as a cunning man, imagines a militia with malicious intent. Well, that's got to be Paulos, Shaul. But they write it the way the English write it, which I made a little note. Yet we ourselves esteem him stricken and smitten of God and afflicted. Well, esteem means to have respect and admire and to value, regard and treasure, you know, in any English dictionary. They didn't do that. He's saying right here that they despised it. They hated it. They hate this plan. Everything about it. They came up with a plan that reverted.
Yeah, they esteemed their plan and hated God.
Exactly, yeah. But they don't write it that way. So you never get it out of the English Bible, to what you just translated.
This is a celebration of Pesach and Matzah, of unyeasted bread and Passover. And you don't have one and a million people to celebrate it. That's the role that's being played here. And they all have a plot to avoid it, whether it's Judaism, Islam, or Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And they've seen the plot, but they despise the truth. And I think this does, by ending in a nah, it affirms something that I guess we have now been talking about for 15 years.
Yes, sir.
That Anah in the over the four Moed Mikra, that it appears, particularly in Yom Kippur, does not mean afflict. It means to respond, to answer. And all God is saying of us is, I want you to respond. I want you to answer the invitation that I have provided for you to party, to celebrate this, recognizing that I've done all the work. Just accept what I've done. So that is what's being conveyed here, and I think by using the verb anah at the conclusion of this fourth statement, is all being brought back to those four Moed Mikra that are so important for us to understand that they are invitations to meet with God, and with God is saying, if you accept them, I'll suffer tribulation, so you won't have to.
Well. What a guy. What a wonderful guy.
Yeah. So, Kirk, my friend, and all of those who are listening, this is the story of Pesach, the story of Matzah. It is the story of the completion and fulfillment of the Torah, presentation of the covenant. One is inseparable from the other. One begins as the other ends. And it's the same ongoing story. And if you're going to accept the covenant, you have to understand how to answer and respond to the Moed Mikra, to these seven invitations to meet with God. They are integrated. It's the same. It is the means that God created to honor and deliver the benefits of the covenant. So there are very few things more important than Yahshua 53.
Yeah.
All right, Kirk, why don't we pick this up again in a week? Because there's way too much to every one of these sentences to go over them quickly.
It truly is, yeah. So I look forward to that.
Yes.
Okay, welcome back. Glad you're back. Have a wonderful time on the beach.
Yeah. Thank you for covering for me last Friday. I appreciate that. This is profound information, and it is so enlightening when seen from the proper perspective and correctly translated. So it's not just about correctly translating it, it's about making the connections, taking the time to look at every word here, and then say, why is this being conveyed to us? What is the message that we can glean from this that helps us understand who God is and what He's offering?
Yeah.
And there's so much of it that is life-altering.
Yes. Some of them are amazing. Yeah.
Now we're into the plan. You know, I have a lot of people say, okay, he's God. He can choose to invite anybody into his home that he wants to. Why did he have to go through this plan? So the only way that he could be honorable and truthful and not be capricious.
Yes.
This plan is the plan that he laid out because it is the single best way, the only way for him to resolve all of the issues that were important so that we could be perfect sons and daughters.
You can't say this matters and then turn around and say, well, this doesn't really matter. I'm going to let you in anyway. It does matter.
No.
Otherwise,
it's
getting around with us.
Right. As important as anything that's ever been revealed, and it takes particular importance when tied into the fulfillment of the covenant and then seen as the perspective from which to view and understand the issue. It brings it all together.
Yes.
It's the essence of the promise. All right, my friend, I think we'll have JP with us next week. I appreciate all of you who are either listening live to the program, participating in the chat room, or who will listen to the archives of this program. May God bless you all.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.